Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The hot story these days, that's General David Petraeus. But to what extent should his extramarital affair be the focus of national media attention? He is, after all, entitled to a private life. But if he put the nation at risk through disclosure of sensitive information, wouldn't that be a different story? We'll focus on that question today with our ethics professors, and we'll also talk about fan behavior at sporting events. Remember last month when Chiefs quarterback Matt Castle suffered a head injury in a game against the Ravens? Well, some fans cheered. The question is, was anything wrong with that? Fans buy a ticket to attend a game, so can't they do just about anything they want once inside? Chiefs tackle Eric Winston didn't think so. He called the fans' behavior sickening and disgusting. We'll sort all this out with our ethics professors. They are Wayne Vaught. He's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Director of the Center for Applied and Professional Ethics at UMKC. Wayne, always good to have you.
Thanks for having me. Wonderful to be here.
Clancy Martin is chair of the Department of Philosophy. He has authored, co-authored, and edited several books in philosophy, including Love, Lies, and Marriage. Clancy, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, let's start with General David Petraeus, gentlemen. His affair is getting all sorts of attention these days. But should it? Is this really a matter of public concern or not? Wayne, what do you think?
Well, I think to the degree that it would become a matter of public concern would be to whether there's actually any real damage that was done by the affair.
And Obama says, the president says, he's not aware of any of this.
Exactly. And it doesn't really appear, even from the media reports, exactly that there is anything that the FBI was finding and the investigation into the allegations. There was clearly an affair that was over with a long time ago, and so this has been coming up. I think that it's certainly an issue that would be relevant for national security. I think it was certainly appropriate that the FBI do an investigation. But I think there's some level of which there should be some internal investigation to determine if there was any element or any breach, any potential compromise of national security. And to the degree that it becomes a public concern, then that would depend on whether there was some actual harm done. You've got the person, though, who's had an affair, a private matter that really makes this case much more sexy and juicy for the media and for headlines. But it really doesn't do anything to increase the security of the nation. It doesn't do anything to put the nation on alert or guard in any way that we can help or prevent these types of things from coming to bear. And we do have, or should have, and I think we do have in place mechanisms to investigate and to deal with the problems as they would come up. So I think that his affair was an issue of national security. I don't think it was an issue of public interest.
Yeah. But boy, it sure is an enticing story, Clancy Martin. I mean, you have all these different elements, including this highly regarded general, highly decorated, and an affair and other people involved. And it's just sitting out there and reporters are running pretty hard with it.
Right. I think Wayne made the elements of the case, the relevant sort of moral and professional elements of the case, very clear. One thing I suppose we could add is that what we have here is a sort of conflict of professionalisms, if you like. The general clearly has a professional code of ethics, which extends into his personal life. I mean, that's just widely recognized when you're in positions of involving high levels of security, especially national security. It extends beyond just your ordinary public life, and then it extends into your private life. Now, we do have, as Wayne said, mechanisms for dealing with internally those kinds of professional indiscretions. And we have another profession that's busy at its work, which is the profession which very legitimately is concerned to expose, especially in government, indiscretions, problems, ethical quandaries. I'm talking about the media, exactly. If the media did not take its professional duty to investigate ethical inquiries carefully, we would never have had Watergate, and we would never have found out a whole bunch of other things that we have found out as a consequence of the media. So you have these two professional domains in conflict. Now, whether there is a further element in this, which is something that I think you can speak to, Steve, better than Wayne can or I can.
That's the first time you've ever said that. About time.
About darn time. Which is the degree to which the media is transforming itself in a variety of different ways, including most obviously things like Jon Stewart, from its old role as the provider of salient information for the public good to salient information for the public amusement or the public entertainment or the salacious information. Now that seems to me that opens up a whole new can of worms where we don't increasingly we don't know what the professional guidelines are. The internet complicates that all the more, and the internet feeds this kind of behavior because people get competitive. Very soon they're competing for facts that aren't facts at all. They're just increasingly salacious information, and it does look as though the media needs to ask itself some tough questions about are we fact finders or are we entertainers?
Boy, and that's a question that would take a whole lot of time to answer, but you're right that the whole empire of the media world is changing so rapidly before our eyes. And what could you do about it, though? I mean, it's a runaway train. We can sit here and talk about it, but no one's going to stop it.
Well, I don't think internally, other than to come up with some codes of professional conduct, which there are codes of ethics in broadcasting and codes of ethics and for journalists. And I think largely they probably do try to live by those. But the fact of the matter is there is a demand for this, that people want to see this, that there are viewers who will turn on those shows and they get viewer time because of what they're doing. And whether it's Jon Stewart or Walter Cronkite, I mean, these are two different sorts of entities. But you have what you have is an appetite for a certain product, and the people are going to deliver that product as long as there is an appetite for it. So I don't think that you're going to be able to contain it. But I think that if you are a person of some level of moral integrity as a journalist, then you're going to try to find, okay, this is what I'm willing to report on and this is what I'm capable of doing. And if you're a legitimate news agency, then that's the tack that you're going to take as well.
Yeah.
And hopefully you will attract the viewers that want to hear those things and not some of the other more salacious sorts of
– Yellow journalism and the paparazzi effect is very old. We've been dealing with it for as long as we've had newspapers, absolutely, because everybody has to sell papers. Everybody has to sell media. On the other hand, we are in every area of a capitalist economy where we want to err on the side of freedom. Nevertheless, we increasingly recognize that mixed markets, that is, robust regulatory bodies and rules combined with the law of demand and supply is what gives us a reasonable balance. So it could – we want to be careful about when we start monkeying with free speech and with the capacity of people to seek out the truth. But that's not – it may be that advertisers need stricter regulation than they have when it comes to ethical content, and it could also be true of the media. I don't know if it should be left only to the sole discretion of the particular individual.
Let me get our listeners involved here. Has the media blown up this story? Has it gone too far with it? Or is it a story that deserves the attention it's getting, this whole General David Petraeus extramarital affair story? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, we're talking about the media doing the right thing. You know, Petraeus did the wrong thing by engaging in the affair, but he did the right thing by resigning very quickly when this thing came to light and stepped out the door and arguably has handled this pretty well.
I would agree. I think you would have to commend him for his actions in that regard. It's taken the attention away from what's currently going on now in the CIA, and so they don't have that particular concern to deal with. Another issue that I think that does come into this, we can talk about the media and its responsibilities and our expectations of it in terms of reporting, but then there's the other issue about being a public figure and to what degree, as you increasingly become a public figure, you give up certain rights to privacy, certain expectations about the level to which one's public life can be exposed. And when you're in a presidency, when you're in the, particularly in this position, and I think a point that Clancy was making earlier is that you know, the newspaper needs to be deeply investigative to uncover potential problems that an internal group might want to conceal. And so you could imagine perhaps it having been the case that there was a potential breach of security because of this affair, and then the CIA, well, let's just cover this up. Mm-hmm. And the media wants to come in and say, no, we're going to report on this because we think it's important for the public to realize the extent to which there's that potential risk. And I think a person in his position does open himself up or herself up to these sorts of investigations simply because the role that you are now playing and the potential implications of even something as common as an affair have such broader implications for the people. There's so many more people that can be affected by that affair than just you and your spouse and the person who's involved, where the average person on the street, if somebody finds out about the affair, it's a very small group of people that are going to be affected by it. This has a much greater extent, and so in that regard, I think the public does have some right to understand what's going on in his private life.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And there is the aspect of this story, the other aspect of this story, Clancy, where all of this is coming to light, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the presidential election. You know, it wasn't before. It's shortly afterwards. Not that this would have changed the course of the election, but it's a fairly significant development. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I think it's a fair question because it would have certainly been deeply inconvenient for the administration before the election if this kind of news had come out, you know, say a week or two before everybody went to the polls. It would have at least not been a good thing for the administration and could potentially have been a very bad thing. So there again, which we don't know why, it could be mere coincidence, but it at least makes us want to err on the side of transparency and to sort of, as I say, you know, we don't want to – the last thing we want to do is be ceding powers of free speech and fact-finding in the interests of security, let's say, national security and the government's ability to protect its own right to keep secrets and to be paternalistic. I mean – The basic notion on which this country was founded is that the government is untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the key idea that the founding fathers had, is that you can't trust the government. So insofar as journalism helps us to confirm that, we got to keep a close eye on the government, journalism does seem to be doing its job.
You put that very succinctly, as Clancy Martin often is wont to do here. Back to some phone calls here, 816-235-2888. Our topic here, General David Petraeus. Should all of this, his extramarital affair, become the story that it's become or not? Let's go to David from Kansas City, Missouri. David, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I guess my opinion is it absolutely shouldn't be the story that it's being covered as, unless there was some classified information that was compromised as a result. I understand this is very embarrassing. I think he did the right thing by stepping down. But, you know, there have been issues that affected the United States, Benghazi, that don't seem to be getting the kind of, you know, day after day airtime that this is.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. Benghazi has sort of been lost to all of this. David, thanks you for the call. You know, writing on CNN.com this morning, Howard Kurtz, the very well-regarded media critic, writes this: we've reached the point where the enormity of the media spectacle far exceeds the news value of the revelation that one of America's top military leaders was also a flawed human being. He thinks the media has gone way too far here. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Diane from Kansas City, Missouri. Diane, you're on Up to Date with our media ethics, our ethics professors.
Great. I'm kind of agreeing with the last caller. I think that they should wait and find out if there actually has been a breach that's significant before this becomes a public issue. Because if there hasn't been a breach, it's a personal issue, and I'm tired of the media culture in the United States just having a meltdown when somebody does something in their personal lives that's, you know, destructive or stupid.
Right. Good points, Diane.
And yeah, I mean, I don't know if so they haven't actually found any problem yet. And I'm disappointed he had to step down. This guy is he's apparently a brilliant. Everyone's real happy with how he's been working, and for something like this to take him out of the picture, and everybody's saying he did the right thing by stepping down. I'm kind of like, dang,
yeah,
why is that the right thing?
A huge loss for the country, Diane. A lot of folks are agreeing with you on that. What about her point there, this idea that should really an extramarital affair drive out this outstanding general? I mean, what a loss for the country.
If we fired everyone, if we went through the history of political and great leaders and we eliminated everyone who had an extramarital affair.
That's always the issue.
We
would have a very small pool of leaders.
A very small pool of leaders, and they probably wouldn't be the ones that we wanted.
Yeah.
So I think it actually is a relevant point. But the happy news is that because of the sort of the gluttony of the media for and the public really for these kinds of salacious things is that people's attention spans are extremely short, and that this will generate way too much media attention for a week or two, and then we'll move on to something else.
The Atlantic is out today with its opinion. This magazine writes, it seems like a growing roster of military leaders are gambling with our nation's trust in them. People charged with life or death decisions should behave in a manner commensurate with their leadership responsibility. So just the opposite point of view from the Atlantic here. Okay, let's go to Leslie from Leawood. Leslie, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone. I some of what I was going to say, Diane brought up, and Clancy's responded, and so on. But I want to reiterate the idea that the media is not always best positioned, especially as a ferreter out of good and different kinds of aspects of the news story. But in this day and age, and the corporate-driven aspects of the media, they hunker down and focus on the race, sort of the horse race elements of it, rather than really what the true story is, and it comes out eventually. So let's say the timeline had been moved 2 weeks. I think, we're almost 2 weeks. Well, I guess we're a week into it. But, I don't feel like we have a really good grasp on what went on in terms of the picture that they're painting in national security and so on. And I don't know that the media, like Dianne Feinstein said, she was outraged she didn't know sooner. Know what sooner, yet. We don't really have a good sense. So, and then the only other argument I had was a point Clancy made was on the founding fathers' main gist was government can't be trusted. I think the government that they came from, they were rejecting, but I don't think they were saying that the public interest wasn't best served by government.
Yeah.
I think that's not the message the founding fathers had. And that's a longer discussion, but I just wanted to bring that up.
Leslie, thank you for the call. I guess to wrap up this part of our conversation today, the Chicago Tribune's opinion is this: the extent to which Petraeus shattered his family is a private matter. The nation's still waiting to find out if he put his nation at risk. Mm-hmm. That's very much a public matter. Maybe to Leslie's point, we don't have all the answers yet at this
point. Absolutely.
Right. Well, let's move on to a different topic here. A few weeks ago, during a game with the Baltimore Ravens, Chiefs quarterback Matt Cassel took a wicked hit and suffered a head injury during a home game. You probably remember what happened next. Some fans cheered. Chiefs offensive tackle Eric Winston was outraged. He called the cheering sickening and disgusting. We got a lot of problems as a society if people think that's okay, he said. And all of this, of course, raises questions, which is, what does the price of a ticket allow a fan to do once he or she's inside? Is it okay to boo poor performance? Or even, in this case, cheer when a struggling quarterback is hurt? Clancy Martin, what do you think?
Well, I think that any time that especially a group of people is cheering the physical harm of another human being, we ought to ask ourselves about how we view ourselves as moral beings, and whether we really think it is appropriate to in any context to endorse some other human being being harmed. I think that this is a very deep question that extends as far as war and the death penalty, and then in narrower contexts like sports. I mean,
meaning the death penalty if you cheer someone else's death,
right? Exactly.
In a case like that,
exactly.
Yeah.
But in the context of sports, of course, if we're not allowed to cheer somebody getting beaten up, then we better eliminate boxing altogether, because mm-hmm. you know, every time you're cheering for your boxer, somebody else is taking a hit really hard in the nose.
Yeah.
I think it's a reason. It's a deeper question than it initially appears to be. Initially, your gut reaction is, well, I mean, that looks like really offensive behavior. Somebody's just been harmed, but. We know when we send football players in there that they are going to be hurting one another. I mean, that's why a lot of people get out of football is because they're so badly hurt. And when they leave the game, an awful lot of these seasons players leave. You know, my good friend who was a history professor at UMKC, Pella McDaniels, had a couple of his fingers fused together because he had to keep playing as a tackle with broken fingers game after game. And that sort of thing is common in professional football. So I'd like Wayne, because he has a lot of experience in refereeing athletic events, to speak to this question. But it does seem to me that gladiatorial sorts of contests put us in a slightly different domain than at least an ordinary, whether we were cheering when a couple of guys are fighting on the street.
Yeah. You know, Wade, is there a distinction here between fans, you know, booing in the case of a quarterback being injured versus booing a team or a player's poor performance? Is either one justified, I guess?
Right. And it's hard to know exactly what – I don't think the fans – were booing a serious injury. I mean, cheering for a serious injury. I think that they were, as probably as part of the game, there was something that happened that they were happy about. But if they were to take the step back, I don't think anybody would be cheering for a brain injury.
I think that this case is fairly clear some Chiefs fans, not all, were
there were some absolutely.
Yeah.
There were some
that were
very happy
injured.
About that. But, I mean, one of the challenges here, and I think Clancy sort of brought the point up, but certainly about the gladiatorial component of football, which is, of you know, dating back to the Romans, this is the most gladiatorial sport that we have. It's still set up very much. I mean, it's not a whole stretch of an imagination to imagine what it would like to be in an arena in Rome when you're at a football stadium. Very similar sorts of things. And it's a bit of the kettle, you know, calling the pot black here in terms of the fans and the athletes, because the athletes are often engaging, and, you know, there have been reports about them being paid to cause injury and hurt people on the field. So there is certainly there's a conduct of the player that I think that it's inappropriate in some ways that might egg some of this on. And there's no way that we can justify fan behavior. Now, the question about whether they can or cannot do that when they buy their ticket is one thing. I don't think that we could police it or stop it. But we can certainly take a step back and say, what exactly is it that you should be doing when you're cheering for or rooting for your particular team? And mm-hmm. if you're getting to the point of cheering for injuries, I think the fans have been led down a particular road. Players have been led down a particular road where this type of thing is occurring, and it does reflect poorly on some innate human desire to see injury to other mm-hmm. humans, which we've seen. I mean, the gladiators of old were you know, much more bloody and much more – it generated a whole lot more cheering. For
I think
those
these
types
were just
things,
frustrated so. Chiefs fans, mm-hmm. frustrated at a quarterback who had been underperforming at least compared to other right. years. And
we're glad he was gone.
Well, glad
out
he's
of
gone.
The picture.
But yeah, maybe not glad he's been injured.
Correct.
I mean, imagine, you know, you're there at the football game and the quarterback goes down and the guy next to you is cheering, and then you notice that your 8-year-old daughter or 8-year-old son is like, yeah, yeah, cheering too. Okay, I would be deeply disturbed at that point.
You got a problem.
Some wouldn't.
And to me, that's kind of a good indicator that there's something morally suspicious about the behavior.
Well, let's move on to the more treacherous question here. It seems to me it's not so much the injury. I think everyone would sort of agree maybe that's going a little too far. How about poor performance on the field in the case of the Chiefs right now? You go to a game, they get behind very early on, as they have almost every game, mm-hmm. with the exception of the last one. Mm-hmm. They get behind early and people get frustrated and they begin to boo the home team. What about that? And let me get our listeners involved in that question as well. 816-235-2888. Is it okay to boo a team in the case of poor performance? Our email address, update@kcur.org. How do you draw that?
I think it is morally problematic. I think that it's problematic from just sort of a social etiquette perspective. I mean, it's when you're entering that particular environment of entertainment, there are looser standards of behavior, and so you'll hear people say things that they won't say. You'll see people do things that they won't do in the course of normal human interactions. You don't do these things on the street. You know, somebody breaks in front of you in line in a grocery store, you're not – well, some people are becoming a little more aggressive, I fear. but I think that it is a reflection. It's sort of a peek into the window of the human psyche. And what it should do is, instead of criticizing just sort of the behavior as it occurs, it should really ask us to take a step back and think about what are the factors that are allowing individuals to reach this particular point in which they are engaging in this sort of activity, and is there some way of stopping it? I know, you know, with kids' sports, you're seeing a lot more opportunities for coaches to want to bring the parents together before a season, talk about what's appropriate behavior, what's inappropriate behavior. Some of the most astonishing behavior I have seen is not a fan yelling sort of generally at the home team, but actually yelling at their own children, saying things that you just couldn't imagine a parent criticizing and ridiculing their children in a public forum during a sports contest. And this sorts of things do go on. And so
But in the case of the Chiefs, people are paying $70, $100, $120 bucks for a ticket for a team that was supposed to contend for mm-hmm. the division championship and yet has been a disaster on the field this year. Fans are frustrated. They don't think the team is putting out enough effort. Is it okay to express your frustration through booing in a circumstance like that?
Right. It certainly seems counterproductive is the first thing I would say. It seems doubtful that your team is going to perform better as a consequence of your booing. Now, further question is, are you booing the team or are you at some level booing the people who put together the team, you know, booing the people responsible for the team's performance, which obviously every individual player is part of that and the team as a whole. But I'm speaking naturally to the coaching staff, et cetera, saying, you know, hey, come on, guys, whatever you're doing here, it's deeply unacceptable. And we want you to know it. And we want you to know it on national television.
Right.
We're booing our own team. You know, it seems to me I myself have never been in a position where I was booing my own team. I remember one time I went to a basketball game where my nephew was playing, and I was sitting there with my mom. So she's watching her grandson play, and she started shouting. He wasn't playing very well, and she started shouting, "Don't pass the ball to Martin! Don't pass!"
Oh no. That's not good.
Yeah, exactly. Boo. Yeah. Booing your children. Well,
And I was
seen this.
I was astonished. I started laughing because I thought she was making a joke, but she kind of had the expression in earnest. And I don't know. It seems to me that I know you're not representing this view, Steve, but there seems to me that there is a point at which one can register legitimately mm-hmm. register protest about particularly to the coaching staff that, hey, you know, you guys are really not getting your act together
right.
here, and we can see it, and we want to let you know.
There's
and there's really only one way for us to let you know. You know, you're not going to listen to our emails, but you are going to listen to 300 of us all at the same time, or 3,000 of us all at the time at the same time saying, that was a really bad call.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Rochelle from Roland Park. Rochelle, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead.
Hey, I got to say, guys, this is a sporting event. Of course you can boo your team if you're mad about how they're playing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the last things we have out there that is honest. If the players are out there and they're playing hard and they're playing well, you cheer. If they're playing badly or they're being coached badly or you're upset with the way the ownership is going, you're going to yell boo as loud as you can because you're mad about it. And you're not telling them that you hate them as people. You hate what they're doing or how they're doing it.
Right.
And I think it's an honest reaction. I hope we continue to react honestly at sporting events and not try to pretend that everybody's a winner. That's ridiculous.
That seems fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's go to, thank you, Rochelle. Bill from Grandview. Bill, good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Go ahead.
I ran a baseball, a youth sports league forever, and the issue about parents and their kids has always been the talk before the season started. You know, cheer for your kids, don't yell at me, et cetera, et cetera. But my bigger question to you is, I'm amused that we are just focusing on the theater of football. What about those audiences that do not respond to a performer on stage? One who does not sing well, or one who doesn't perform well, or somebody who hisses or boos or talks during the performance because it isn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be any different than those who react to in a loud open stadium where you have to be yelled to hear things? I think the ethics belongs to the performers, those who decide to put themselves in the public light and say, yes, I will perform to my best ability. And most often, the audience is there looking at the consequences of their action and not necessarily their actions.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason that popular website for movies is called Rotten Tomatoes, you know, and that's because people used to throw Rotten Tomatoes
right.
if someone
that's
wasn't
right.
performing well. So I think you bring up a good point. There's a long history here mm-hmm. of the etiquette of public performance, mm-hmm. and what that history tells us is that fans are actually encouraged to respond mm-hmm. to people who've paid for a ticket are encouraged mm-hmm. to respond to the success or failure of the performer.
Dates back, I mean, to the Shakespeare days.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
This is what you would have the groundlings that would sit there, and if they weren't happy, they were throwing things up on the stage about the performance.
Just briefly, gentlemen, what about folks who pay to go to a NASCAR event or a hockey game hoping to see a fight, NASCAR hoping to see a crash? I mean, how do you evaluate that in terms of from a moral standpoint? That, you know.
Well, you remember when that one, this is tangential, but you remember when that one hockey dad killed the other hockey dad about 10 years or so ago, actually murdered him
mm-hmm.
during one of these kinds of displays. And those guys were clearly sort of pro fight hockey dads. I don't know. It's a deep and interesting question. There's a long histories written about, particularly by a philosopher named Michel Foucault, who was influenced by a philosopher named Friedrich Nietzsche, both of whom studied the question of whether the drive, what they called the drive to cruelty, was just a natural human drive that was going to be expressed one way or another, and how what they called festivals of cruelty have evolved over time. It could be that it's unrealistic of us as human beings to suppose that our need to, in one way or another, express cruelty is just going to vanish from human nature, and that it just has to be sublimated into less and less violent forms.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. I'm way overdue on one here with our ethics professors. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll turn to a topic about space junk and what to do with all the junk we've left up in the way outer atmosphere and what our obligation is as a country to deal with all of that. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, an interview with Christopher Walken, the great actor, and also reviews of the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. This hour, we're visiting with our ethics professors. They are Wayne Vaught, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC, Clancy Martin. He is chairman of the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Coming up in just a moment, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Well, new topic, gentlemen. NASA now estimates that the cloud of orbital debris surrounding Earth contains more than, get this, 22,000 pieces that are as big as a softball and more than 500,000 pieces bigger than a marble. Only 1,100 of these objects are still active satellites. Meantime, the U.S. has announced that it will work with other nations to develop an international code of conduct when it comes to outer space. My question is, how responsible, from a moral standpoint, is the U.S. when it comes to cleaning up its mess in outer space? I'm sure it's an issue you've been worried about quite a bit lately.
I have. I was fretting over this just the other day. What are we going to do with all the space junk floating around? Any time a person engages in a behavior that's going to have implications, and the implications can be known, you have to say that there's some moral responsibility for the consequences of those actions. And that we have all this space junk floating around, I mean, that space is a pretty big place. So there's a question of what do those numbers really mean? And I can't interpret that. What are the potential harms from it? Is it that they would fall down? I think probably most of the junk would disintegrate if it were to come into Earth's atmosphere. But there's potential other potential harms, some of which I'm, you know, personally not even aware of. But the people who are putting that and putting more stuff up into space certainly need to recognize the consequence of that and be prepared to be able to effectively deal with those consequences. So to the degree that the U.S. has been responsible for funding and putting things into space, and now we're going to find that this is causing problems, well, we have a responsibility to effectively deal with and address the problems that's going to be caused by that junk.
You know, Clancy, you even wonder, I guess this is sort of beyond the scope of our expertise here in this room right now, but is it possible to go up there and collect these 22,000 pieces of junk that are as big as a softball? I mean, how do you do that?
Right. I mean, the reason that I'm glad you've brought this into the show, Steve, and that it's helpful that we're talking about it is I think everyone recognizes that where this conversation really started is the amount of junk that we've dumped into the sea, where you have a very similar situation.
Great point.
You know, no one in particular is responsible for what's been dumped into the sea because it's a public good. No particular nation owns it. Nevertheless, certain nations dump a lot more junk in there than other nations do, and I'm sure many people have seen those horrifying pictures on the internet of these gigantic islands, some of them as big as 3 or 4 miles across, that are nothing, that are stable in the ocean, that are nothing but garbage. And so the fact that people are starting to talk about the fact that we're, you know, we've got islands made of garbage in the sea, now we're going to start making gigantic belts made of garbage orbiting the Earth. The point is that we don't want to we did this thoughtlessly with the ocean for a long time. We're just now developing the technology, you know, really in just the past. We've been able to dump junk in the ocean for as long as we've been human beings.
Right.
We've only been able to dump junk into space for about the past 50 years or so.
Yeah.
So the fact that the conversation now is taking place about regulations such that we can't dump junk into space and may in fact have obligations to get it out of there.
Yeah.
Is very encouraging. There's something that our listeners might be interested to know about. It's an effect in economics that interferes with classical economical theory, which tells us if we are capitalists that in any exchange, as long as both parties are happy with the exchange and it's a free market, there are no monopolies, the collective effect is net good. And so the exchange itself is good. And this is the fundamental defense of capitalism. Well, one exception to that rule is called the pollution effect. And the reason that it's an exception is there are people bearing the costs of pollution who are not engaged in the exchange. And that's precisely what we're talking about here.
Very well said, Clancy.
Is that, you know, it's primarily Americans and then probably also the French to some degree and the Russians to some degree and increasingly the Chinese who are putting the junk up there because the vast majority of the nations in the world simply don't have the ability to put the junk up there.
We just have a minute left here, Wayne, but maybe the bigger question is when we explore other planets, for example, how ethical is it to exploit the resources we find once we explore them? I mean, it's a whole different kind of issue, but you do wonder sometimes.
Exploiting the resources on these planets?
Yes.
It's an open space. There can be some human advantage to utilizing those resources. So I don't think there's anything inherently immoral about it. The problem becomes if there are now then detrimental consequences from it, harms that are caused to other people, then we have to address what those would be. But, I mean, just as available resources that – you know, in and of themselves, you're not depriving anyone of access on those planets, obviously, to the resources.
We'd much rather have them do fracking in Mars than we'd have them do fracking Iowa.
Right. Yeah. Or southern Kansas,
pipeline.
For that matter.
Yeah, southern Kansas, exactly.
Gentlemen, we are out of time, but I always appreciate when the two of you come in. Our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both from UMKC. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having us, Steve.